Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend, three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. One signature of the Trump administration is not just the number of people his election has spurred to take to the streets in protest, but who they are. Women, also known as half the population. People who want to see the president's tax returns, something all presidents since the 1970s have released. And now, scientists and people who care about science. Yes, scientists around the world are leaving their labs to march in favor of facts and evidence. Big marches are planned for this Saturday, April 22nd, Earth Day. One of the organizers of the Earth Day March for Science joins us now, Brooklyn's own Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, who is a marine biologist and now activist. Dr. Johnson, welcome to WNYC and the Green Space.
Thank you for having me.
So what's happening on Saturday?
So on Saturday, we march for science. This is something I never thought I would be doing, helping to organize a march for science. As someone who has marched in the Women's March for Black Lives Matter, thinking about how we care for immigrants in this country, I never thought I would have to organize something about facts and the scientific method and the value of science in society and the role it really should be playing in policymaking that's based on evidence instead of opinion and conjecture. So we have marches in 514 cities around the world. Thank you. It's really exciting that this has become an international movement, because it's not just in the U.S. that we're seeing this problem of science being sidelined in the policymaking process. And we have about 250 partner organizations, from scientific societies to nonprofits to museums and aquariums, which are so important as the interface between science and the public. So we're really excited about the fact that this is an extremely broad and diverse coalition, social science, natural science, and we're talking about biologists, physicists, chemists, but also, you know, social science, so economics and sociology, anthropology, archaeology, everything about how we understand the world, what humans are doing to it, and then how we can use that information to make good decisions that keep us safe and healthy and all of that good stuff.
And listeners, we can take a few phone calls for Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 on the coming March for Science this Saturday. And those of you in the green space, you can raise your hand if you want to ask a question. You said something interesting in that answer about the rest of the...
Well,
you said a lot interesting in that answer, but something in particular about the rest...
I don't want to bore you in the first minute.
about the rest of the world, that this isn't the only country where this is going on. And I think Americans who care about science might, in general, have the impression that we are kind of uniquely subject to religious ideologues who push back against science and corporate interests who push back against science for their purposes, that this doesn't happen in these ways so much elsewhere. Did you have any particular examples in mind?
I wish I did. We were talking with one of the organizers of the march in Berlin, and he had some great examples of things that were happening in Europe. So I'm sure Science March Berlin's social media feed would be a good place to look. But I think in general, the challenge that underlies that broader issue that you brought out is actually the problem of, is science interesting, right? So we can laugh about it, but because scientists have not done a great job of explaining the value of their work to the public, that's how we've gotten ourselves in this pickle where people feel like they can just ignore science and evidence in favor of their opinions. And so the March for Science is really excited about helping to push for scientific literacy and helping to break down that wall between scientists and the public, not have science be this thing that happens somewhere in a lab. Most science doesn't even happen in labs. So breaking down that wall, helping to explain why science is so important to our health and well-being. So that's why this march is not just a moment, but really the start of this movement to help reestablish science in the place that we think it needs to be.
How much do you think the Trump administration is really against science versus how much do you think you just have policy differences based on what the proper response is to the data?
When government data sets start disappearing from federal websites, it's not a difference of opinion. When scientists are being censored and not allowed to talk about the results of their research, that's not an opinion. That's like suppressing evidence that should be used to make sure our drinking water is safe and our air is clean and our food is healthy and not poisonous. That our cell phones work, that our data is secure, that our bridges don't collapse, that our medicine can heal us. I mean, I think the problem is that we forget how valuable science is in our daily lives. It seems like something that only comes up once in a while as like a, did you learn this fun fact from science today? But really it's something that's pervasive and needs to be appreciated as something much more foundational.
You've written that you, quote, have a crush on the scientific method. Do you want to share what it is and what you love about it?
Oh, my gosh. Yes, that is an accurate quote. I love how elegant it is and how clear it is. It's this extremely rational process for coming up with an idea, a question, a hypothesis, doing an experiment to see whether or not it stands up to experimentation, taking that first result and then saying, can I get this result again? Or is this an outlier? Is this aberrant? And then can other scientists also repeat it? In what scenarios does this hypothesis hold true? And so through this process of the scientific method, we can learn amazing things about what's actually happening in the world. And it just seems so foolish to me that we would not make use of this opportunity to have a factual basis for policymaking.
Let's take a question from here in the green space. Hi there.
Hi there. Good morning. I'm just wondering, in this, you know, quote unquote age of ignorance that we're living in, where facts and figures and knowledge seems to be kind of a afterthought, how do we get people to really get involved and pay more attention to things like climate change and all of these agencies that seem to be, you know, the dismantling is the modus operandi of this administration. Does that make sense?
How do we get people to pay attention?
Yes.
Well, step one, everyone go march on Saturday. I mean, that's a big reason why we're doing this. It's not because like we need to count our steps and our apps or whatever so that we can get our points. It's because we really need to show our numbers in standing up for science. One of the hashtags we're using is science, not silence. So making sure that scientists and science advocates are really starting to talk about all this stuff. The official hashtag is also March for Science. But I think having the March for Science is this moment to have attention. And obviously it's really important to figure out how to sustain that conversation. And there are lots of ways that science and the scientific community can be better, obviously at communicating, but also about being more inclusive, doing research that the public that is more useful to the public, that is more exciting to the public, finding creative new ways to convey that. And all of those are things that are part of our longer term plan as well.
And I see that you're a member of the March's diversity team and that there was some pushback early on over the idea of inclusionary language and the idea of data-driven science. Where did you land?
Oh, our whole team wholeheartedly embraces the value of diversity, inclusion, and science. The pushback really was from outside people, outside scientists not involved with the march, who said, this is a distraction. Just talk about science. And our response was, who do you think does science? It's humans. So the fact that I'm a black woman from Brooklyn doing marine biology actually matters, and that my father is Jamaican really does matter. Your history matters in terms of what science you do. So I do science that's focused on sustainable fishing in Caribbean fishing communities and how to make sure that the views of fishermen are incorporated into management. That's based on science, but also community concerns and priorities. And someone who doesn't have the same background as me might not be interested in that research, might not be asking those same questions. So who does science? Who gets funded to do science? Who has access to good science education? All informs what science is done and what communities are served by that science. So another part of what the March for Science is going to be doing in the longer term is really pushing for scientific literacy and scientific education. So kids in the Bronx and Kansas have great science educations and have the same opportunities and exposure so that they can grow up and be the next generation of scientists asking the questions, doing the research that their communities need.
And you included social science earlier.
Absolutely.
On your list of things that it's important to protect. You know that science, that social science has been used at times in the past to reinforce prejudice. So is it sort of in a morally different category from physical sciences like marine biology?
No, I mean, medical science also has a really storied history of experimenting on marginalized peoples in a way that's just horrific, whether it's like forced sterilizations or giving people STDs on purpose to see what happens to them. You have, and we have like eugenics and all sorts of stuff on all sides of this. So I think there's a really dirty history of science and diversity that I'm really glad is being talked about more. And this is why diverse scientists matter, because they're making sure that people with a huge spectrum of backgrounds are part of the scientific process is what can prevent those horrible things from happening again. So science is not immune from bad decision making, just like science is not independent from politics. It's not independent from all of the negative trends that we see socially. So we have to deal with racism and sexism and xenophobia and ableism and privilege within the scientific community. It's a microcosm for the greater society. So I think the March for Science is really shining a light on these issues within science, which we need to deal with as a community. So it's a painful airing of some of our dirty laundry, but it's a really good time to be having these conversations.
We'll continue in a minute with marine biologist and March for Science organizer Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, live in the green space, 212-433-WNYC. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live in the green space today with our guest, Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, marine biologist and an organizer of Saturday's March for Science here in New York, a big one in Washington, and how many places around the world did you say?
514 and counting.
Yikes.
Official satellite marches.
That's a lot of math to go with the science. Let's take a question from here in the green space. Hi there.
Hi there. I'm wondering, how will you measure the success of the march? Because if you look at the Women's March, in terms of numbers, that was certainly a success. But, you know, what has it really led to, right? We heard earlier that, you know, Planned Parenthood is slowly but surely being defunded. So, you know, is it just a numbers game that if you get a lot of people, you know, to rally in Washington, that that's a success? And, you know, isn't it in some ways just really a parade of supporters marching in front of themselves?
Marching in front of them, that one I haven't heard before. It's like an out-of-body experience. I think that's a really, really important question. because you're absolutely right that if this ends with just a march, that's not success. But I think this is a really important moment for several reasons. One, It is a celebration of science and the value of science and starting to tell those stories. We'll have an amazing list of speakers that's being announced today who will be able to tell an incredible spectrum of stories about the different types of science that are happening and that are important to start to bring the public into these conversations. And the work that I've been doing with the March is I'm co-director of partnerships for the National March, which means I've been helping to build this coalition of 249, as of this morning, organizations and counting, who are partnering with us, not just for the March, but hopefully for the longer term. And that means that these are the organizations we'll be working with to improve scientific literacy, to bring science into communities and break down the wall between science and the public, to engage more in policy. We'll be releasing a policy platform sometime in the next week or two, talking about the specific areas of policy that we'd like to see changes or supported. So this is definitely, and it's also a moment for people who care about science to realize how many colleagues they have, how much support this there is for all of this. So there's a lot of value in a march in creating a cohesion, creating this coalition, and creating inertia to move things forward. So if we weren't having a march, I wouldn't be here on the radio right now. We wouldn't be talking about these issues. So we want to use this as an opportunity to bring a lot of things into the public discourse, into the zeitgeist, and keep it there for as long as we can. Obviously. But in the long term, we definitely want this to keep going. And there are a lot of, there's a lot of important work to do. One thing I would just mention that I was really excited to read about in the last few days was a Scientific Integrity Act has been introduced in both the House and the Senate. So Congress is thinking about what they need to do to engage and protect the role of science in federal policymaking as well. So lots of work to be done over the next few days and months and years as well.
Let's take another question from here in the green space. Hi there.
Hi, I was just curious if you are involved with the Union for Concerned Scientists, if they're one of your partner groups, and do you think that's an effective organization for people who are not scientists to join and be supportive of what's going on right now?
Yes, they were. The Union of Concerned Scientists was one of our first partners, and we're very excited to have their support. The name doesn't say it all, but it certainly says a lot. They are one of the organizations that worked really hard between the election and the inauguration to download and archive government data sets. So this was the thing that got me involved in the March for Science, that really opened my eyes to exactly how dire a situation we were in, that scientists were worried that government data sets on climate change, on endangered species, and on were just going to disappear. And we're already starting to see things come down from government websites. So Union of Concerned Scientists helped with that archival process, and they're a wonderful partner to have. So I definitely encourage people to check out the resources on their website.
And as we run out of time, I see that you're partnering with various organizations here in New York for the New York edition of the March on Saturday. I see that starts at 10:30 Saturday morning at Central Park West and 62nd Street for those who are interested and who aren't going to the Washington March. And you have New York partners?
Yes, we do. As a marine biologist, I'm extremely excited that we have the New York Aquarium as a partner. And the Bronx Zoo, both run by the Wildlife Conservation Society. Our newest partner is the World Ocean Festival also, which is going to be happening in Gantry Park on June 3rd in tandem with the UN's Ocean Conference around their sustainability development goal for that. So lots of exciting stuff happening in New York and all over. And please join us. You can go and find more at marchforscience.com, and you can RSVP at marchforscience.com/RSVP, hashtag marchforscience, at marchforsciencedc. We have all the info you need. If you want to send it to friends who are in different cities, there's probably a march near them. But this is the first chance to stand up and be counted, and science, not silence, and all that good stuff.
And do you have a particular poignant hat that everybody's going to wear, like at the Women's March?
No hats required. I'm sure there'll be plenty of like nerdy science jokes on signs that don't necessarily help to break down that barrier between science and society, but like long game, we're working on our science communication skills.
I definitely have a crush on nerdy science jokes. And we'll have to put some on the air later in the week. And leave it there for now with Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, marine biologist, consultant, adjunct at NYU, currently the partnership's co-chair for the
NYU
March.
NYU is actually a partner of the March.
Okay. March for Science, Saturday in Washington and 500 cities around the world, including New York. Dr. Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Science is real.
We'll continue with the show in just a minute, but first we'd like to ask you for a little bit of help. When you get a chance, please visit wnyc.podcastingsurvey.com and tell us a little about you and the podcast you love in a 5-minute anonymous survey. You can find the link in the show notes for this episode. We really appreciate your help. Knowing more about you helps us make more of the shows you enjoy. Thank you from all of us at The Brian Lehrer Show, wnyc.podcastingsurvey.com. It's The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, live from the green space. Good morning again, everyone. Joining me now is renowned historian David McCullough. He's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for his biographies of Presidents John Adams and Harry Truman, also the National Book Award. He hosted The American Experience on PBS for 12 years, narrated Ken Burns' Civil War documentary, and has even been given our nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. David McCullough is also known for his speeches that often contextualize contemporary issues with pertinent moments from American history. That may all be moot now, as we may have jumped the shark of American history as we know it 89 days ago. We'll find out what David McCullough thinks, but he's curated and edited 15 of his speeches for his latest book, The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For, in hopes that they will, quote, remind us of those things at this particular moment. Please welcome David McCullough to WNYC and the Green Space. And listeners, we can take some phone calls for David McCullough at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Just for a little political context around the current moment, you've kept your political views private for most of your career, but you came out strongly against Trump, I see, during the election campaign. You're 83 years old. Why now?
Because I felt that we were going down a very dangerous track, and that we had to put the brakes on and stop and consider who we are, what we stand for, and are we going to dispense with all of that in order to put someone in the pilot seat who's never, ever flown a plane before and who doesn't understand how our government works, who has no interest in the history of the country and has said so on more than one occasion, has never read a book about the presidency or a biography of a president, and claims, as he said in an interview in the Washington Post, that he doesn't need to read books because he knows so much intuitively. And I remember Jefferson said, any nation that expects to be ignorant and free expects what never was and never will be. We are a country based on the love of learning, on the improvement of our way of life through learning. We are people who believe in the truth. We are people who believe in tolerance, who believe in hard work and having aspirations beyond material acquisition. And we want to bring our children up that way. I've dedicated this book to my 19 grandchildren because I hope that what I have to say will extend beyond my own children's generation to the new one coming on. And I really know from a lifetime in the field that I've made my specialty that one of the best of all ways to learn about almost anything is to read history. And that history isn't just about politics and the military. It's about life. It's about art and music and dance and science and finance. It's about human beings. It's not boring statistics. It's not memorizing dates, heaven knows, or quotations. It's about human beings and how we can attain aspirations that we may think impossible if we work together.
I see at a speech that you gave at Dartmouth in 1995 that's included in the book, while stressing the importance of reading history, you said, "I don't think we can ever know enough about our presidents, and particularly before putting them in the job. The truth is, of course, it makes an enormous difference who is in the White House."
A tremendous difference. And we can't expect an exceptional president every time. Exceptional presidents, as I try to tell students, exceptional presidents are the exception. But they do happen, and they often happen in a surprising way. Harry Truman, I think, probably being as strong an illustration of that as anyone. And they're very different from one another. I have known through interviews or time spent with seven of our presidents, and they are all interesting figures and all quite different from each other. The two I know best are Harry Truman and John Adams. And I was asked once at the end of a talk I gave at a university in California, the questioner said, "Aside from Harry Truman and John Adams, how many others have you interviewed?" I had to explain that appearances notwithstanding, I did not know John Adams or Harry Truman.
And I heard, who was it, W.E.B. Du Bois, making a comeback these days?
Yeah, right. That wonderful line of Gerald Ford's, "If Abraham Lincoln were alive today, he'd be turning over in his grave." Gerald Ford, by the way, is a much misunderstood president. He was much more important and admirable president than he's generally perceived as, and an interesting presidency. He didn't last very long, but an awful lot happened. And there's a good man working on a good biography of Ford now, I understand, which I'm very pleased about. I spent much of one whole day with him, and I was so struck by how different he was from the way he had been portrayed. You know, the fellow that wore his football helmet, well, played without his helmet and would fall down when he got off an airplane. A president can make one little mistake like that and just they don't let up on it. Lyndon Johnson loved to tear Ford apart unfairly.
He was president for such a short amount of time.
Yes.
After the impeachment or the resignation prior to impeachment of Richard Nixon.
And nobody ever had to be interviewed for the job. And you go be passed on by... Well, anyway.
Were you just impressed with him as a person when you spent time with him? Or
yes.
Is there something about his legacy
He finished the White House, and I was invited to the Ford Library in Michigan to come and give a talk. And he not only showed me around the museum, but talked at length and quite candidly about various people and about various problems. And I was struck by his... He seemed to have both feet on the ground about the work. He was a very professional, full-time public servant his whole working life. And it's a profession. It's a trade. You have to know it. You can't just jump right in and think, oh, I'll know how to do this. It doesn't work that way. And the qualities that I think are essential above all our strength of character.
Uh-oh.
Well, in the on the mantelpiece in the White House, there is a line carved into the marble that's taken from a letter written by the first president ever to occupy the White House. That was John Adams. He was there overnight for the first time of any human being that's ever been president. And his wife was delayed in coming with him, and he wrote her a letter in which he said, among other things, "May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof." And that was carved, had, first of all, Franklin Roosevelt had it carved into the, what was the wood of the fireplace, and then President Truman, when they rebuilt the White House, had it replaced, and then John Kennedy, when he was president, had a change made, had it carved into the marble, so it was certain to last. And what I think is so powerful about that is he said, "May none but honest and wise men." He puts honest first.
And he put men in particular.
Yes. Well, that's all we knew yet. And still, but honest and wise men. And those are the fundamental values of tolerance and optimism and the capacity to use the English language. Imagine that. Imagine. And to think before you speak.
Is the amount, people would push back, you know, there are Trump supporters who push back on that he's really actually brilliant at using the English language. Was it Bannon? I realize it was quoting Steve Bannon on Donald Trump, but I think it was Bannon who said he's the greatest orator since William Jennings Bryan. He gets these crowds.
What do you want? You want me to...
Well, I mean, you know...
That's ridiculous. Abraham Lincoln, John Kennedy. I was asked to give the memorial talk at Kennedy's memorial service in Dallas just a few years ago, 50th anniversary. And I went back and reread Kennedy's speeches. And, oh, my goodness, breathtaking, thrilling. And one of the things very interesting about Kennedy is he almost never talked, think of this, never talked about himself. Mm. The first person singular very seldom enters in. And the idea that he said, "We will go to the moon." That's American. That's we can undertake hitherto seemingly impossible accomplishments and succeed if we work together.
My guest here in the green space, excuse me, on the Brian Lehrer Show is the renowned historian David McCullough. His new book, a collection of speeches that he's given over the years, is called The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. We can take some phone calls for David McCullough at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or if you have a question for David McCullough here in the green space, raise your hand and we'll come around with a microphone. We're being, you know, pretty direct here about Trump, but I'm going to continue it. Is the amount of lying at the level of just making stuff up outside the norms of American political history,
yes,
or is it naive to think
yes,
that?
Yes, it is.
It is.
But let me make a point that I think needs to be expressed by lots of us. The job that the media is doing today, print, to be sure, but radio and television too.
Internet, too.
Excels any performance of their responsibility that I know of in our past. It's superb. They are rising to fill the very role that the Constitution declares to be their responsibility. And it's some of the best reporting, the fairest, most accurate reporting that I can remember. And when they publish the things that are being said on a weekly basis as kind of a calendar of this last week's of what aren't true. That's marvelous. And because who are we to know if somebody doesn't remind us what he just said isn't true? And what is so disturbing is he doesn't seem to care. Now, do we want to raise our children and grandchildren on that kind of ethical standard? And
what does it say to you about the American people, in whom I think you have great faith?
I do.
That so much of this was known during the campaign at the level of character, and enough people to elect him voted for him anyway.
That enough people were sufficiently distressed about their place in life and how the fortunes of life seem to be so often against them, that they were willing to grasp out at almost any snake oil salesman who happened along. That's my interpretation.
In your speech to Ohio University in 2004, in the book titled The Bulwark of Freedom, you said, when bad news is riding high and despair is in fashion, when loud mouths and corruption seem to own center stage, when some keep crying that the country is going to the dogs, remember, it's always been going to the dogs in the eyes of some. Is that a good quote for today?
I hope so. I meant it then, and I mean it now. I think that we are a good country. 90% of us are great people, good people, wanting to do the right thing, work hard every day, try to be a work on time, raising our children as best we can, educating them as best we can. And we shouldn't lose heart because there's always so much bad news in the forefront. Bad news moves newspapers and brings people to television. I'm concerned that we are becoming a nation of spectators, and I'm very concerned about the influence of big money on politics. I think we all ought to be very concerned about that and stop it as soon as it's possible to stop it.
Let's go to a question for David McCullough here in the green space. Hi.
Hi. I'm interested in hearing about how you've seen the role of history in political discourse change over the course of your career as a historian. And I say that because Donald Trump is in some ways aggressively ahistorical, but his campaign has also kind of drawn on a mythological history of America in an interesting way.
And your question is?
So my question is, how has the role of history in political discourse changed?
The role of history in affecting political discourse?
Or how people use history in making political arguments.
If it has.
I really don't understand the question.
I guess he's asking...
Try.
How do politicians use history to convince Americans?
Politicians traditionally have all been using history, knowing history, and using it effectively from when we first began as a country. We have never had a great president who wasn't a scholar, a reader, a believer in history. You can just see them all the way along. Woodrow Wilson was a professor of history. Theodore Roosevelt wrote an excellent history of the Naval War of 1812 when he was still in college. Dwight Eisenhower's Crusade in Europe is, I think, one of the very best books ever written about the history of the Second World War, and he wrote it all himself. Harry Truman, who never went to college, never stopped reading history. He said, the only new thing in the world is the history you don't know. And he understood that what presidents don't do is often as important as what they do do. So when he decided that he would not use the atomic bomb in Korea, that was a momentous decision. When Eisenhower decided, I will not go into Vietnam, another immensely momentous decision. And the history is about cause and effect, and history sets examples of leadership. The best leaders are all readers. It's been true all along. And you can't ignore the life of the mind, and you can't ignore the lessons that history teaches us in all of aspects of life.
politicians often misuse history, I would imagine, in making points that are either inaccurate or don't create accurate analogies to things that are going on today?
Yes. Well, anybody can find something in the Bible that makes their point. And history is much like that, because history is many-sided. History is human. That's the essential thing to remember.
On the other hand, I remember when Michelle Obama said, I'm living in a house that was built by slaves, and that may not have been something that has been on Americans' minds, and she brought it back to the fore.
Well, it should be brought back to the fore. The first president to occupy the White House, John Adams, never owned a slave. Never owned a slave as a matter of principle, because he didn't believe it. He thought he was wrong. His wife felt even more strongly on the attitude. The next president who didn't believe in slavery was their son, John Quincy Adams. We had seven presidents who were all slaveholders. But at the same time, keep this in mind, our country doubled in size with what was called the Northwest Ordinance, which brought in what are now the states of Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Illinois. And the Congress of the United States, before we had a constitution, the summer of 1787, passed the Northwest Ordinance, in which it was ordained forever that there, in that territory, there would be no slavery. That was equal to half of all the country in territory. Now, granted, there was no one living there except Native Americans at the time. But nonetheless, it was a huge step in the right direction, which we don't pay any attention to or give any credit for the very people who let the Constitution go through without having slavery.
We have a question right here, I think. Hi.
Hi. Professor McCullough, if I understood you right when you talked about why Trump was able to be elected by enough people in this country to become president, do you think there's some way in which Obama's presidency set us up for Trump at this time?
Well, there's unquestionably an element in our country still that feels not at ease with an African-American president, as there are many people who were against Mrs. Clinton because she was a woman. But at the same time, we elected Barack Obama. And at the same time, let us not forget that Mrs. Clinton won the election with a popular vote of nearly 3 million people. So it is, the loser is the total loser. She wasn't a total loser. She was, in fact, the winner. And that ought to give us inspiration. That ought to give us hope that we can approach male, female, black, white in a fair and open-minded way.
Also on the dissatisfaction in the land today, as a historian, maybe we have lived through an ahistorical bubble of good times in this country after World War II that is just not sustainable unless the whole rest of the world is on its knees and unless technology ceases to progress. And so we have today's sense of decline from the standpoint of the wealthiest country in the history of the world. And maybe it's an ahistorical bubble, and we need that context to even begin this conversation.
No, I don't agree. I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because, yes, you can say we're on decline, but in many ways we are not on decline. We are on the upward path. Look what has been accomplished in our lifetimes in medicine. My God. Unbelievable. That happened here. It didn't happen anywhere else. Look what we've created in our higher educational system in this country. Now, yes, well, there are problems with it. Yes, it's become too expensive. But we've created the greatest universities and colleges in the world in our lifetime. And that's no minor achievement. We've also given more opportunity to more of our people of all kinds and races, colors, everything. And let's never forget that we are all immigrants.
Obama made a big point of saying we're living at the best time to be alive in the history of the world. It sounds like you agree.
I do agree. That's not to say we don't have problems, but we have always had problems. Problems are what we call life. And if we're going to think, oh, we got a terrible problem, then we're spoiled brats who haven't any realization of what happened before us. We have to know what our predecessors have been through, what they sacrificed, what they did in the cause of improvement, of progress, of both emotional and intellectual and physical and material progress. What they went through in the Civil War, what they went through in the influenza epidemic of 1918, 1919. Most people don't know anything about that. 500,000 Americans died in less than 1 year of influenza. If that were to happen today, given our population, it would be 1.5 million people would die from a disease that we don't know where it came from, we don't know how it is going to go away, and so forth. Imagine that on the nightly news today. What a state of agitation and frenzy and madness we'd be in. But they got through it, just as they got through the Depression and those horrendous world wars.
Anthony in Greenberg, New York. You're on WNYC with David McCullough. Anthony, you there? Can we bring Anthony up? Can you help me in the control room? There we go. Anthony, I think we have you now. Actually, control room, give me a hand on this. There we go. We have you. I apologize, everybody. It's a little different in the green space to put the calls on the air. Hi, Anthony.
Yeah, I'm a great fan of this. I have a history degree from Mercy College. And I wanted to say, he just said something really, really poignant to me about how white people have become dissatisfied in this country and feel like they've been left out. You know, I'm black, and we've been left out for 200 years. You know, nobody ever recognizes that. They say all of a sudden white people are so disaffected, so disenfranchised. Well, black unemployment is still down. You know, black pay rate is lower than white people's pay rates. You know, I mean, I don't understand. What do they think President Obama gave black people? Because he became president, we didn't raise up any. Mass incarceration is still there for our people. Most of us go to jail for big crimes that white people don't go to jail for. You know, and I don't understand why they're so dissatisfied. We've been dissatisfied. It's not like we won anything when Obama became president.
What's the legacy of Obama for you, Anthony? Is it nothing in particular?
Elected a president. No, that we elected a black man as president.
I hear you.
Brilliant man too, a brilliant black man, and he was a good president. You know. On the other hand, I still think when people talk about deportation, nobody cries. Obama deported more people than Trump has deported right now. You know, but he had his shortcomings. But
Anthony, I think I accidentally disconnected Anthony. But Anthony, we get your points and keep calling us. You're back on the. Oh, okay, you're done. Okay, thank you very much. I apologize, Anthony, for being clunky technically on your call. One more thought?
Yes, I think Harry Truman said you have to wait 50 years for the dust to settle in order to judge a president. And it's very hard to say how history will treat Barack Obama. My guess is history will treat him very well. He brought to the White House a sense of balance, not just about the racial makeup of our country and the injustices that black people have endured, but he brought an intellectual level to the White House that was superb. And I didn't agree with everything he did, but I thought he brought also a marvelous First Lady. And he was and remains a gentleman. He showed us how to behave like a grown-up gentleman of responsibility in the most important leadership role in the world and in all history. Nobody can do the job perfectly. Nobody can be in there more than a couple of months and not make mistakes. But that's the nature of it. And we have to be very careful what kind of people we choose and what kind of people we encourage to pursue a life in public service. We must not let politics become a responsibility, a role as citizens, which nobody wants to have anything to do with anymore. We need to summon the best that's in us to take these roles.
I want to thank David McCullough and Simon & Schuster for giving a copy of David's new book to everybody here in the green space. Thank you so much. David McCullough's new book, a collection of his speeches, is called The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. Thank you so much. It's been a great honor. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. There have been a number of marijuana-related stories in the news recently. So today on April 20th, as people around the world celebrate marijuana culture as part of what is known as 420, we'll get into the weeds on marijuana policy in the news with my guest, Mark Kleiman. He's professor of public policy at NYU, author of the book Drug Policy, What Everyone Needs to Know, and very pertinently, he's a former marijuana legalization consultant for Washington State, which you may know is one of 8 states that has legalized recreational marijuana use to date. He was on with us when Washington State began its program to discuss the nuts and bolts of implementing legalization of recreational marijuana, and he's back with us now to talk about several marijuana news items, including Canada's push to become only the second nation to legalize marijuana, the disapproval of these legalization state referenda in the United States by U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Can he actually stop them in their tracks? The difficulty of obtaining medicinal marijuana right here in New York State, now that that's been recently legalized, and his observations on Washington's pot policy almost 3 years after retail marijuana sales began in that state. So, Mark Kleiman, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. And after that list of questions, I want to know what we're going to do in the third hour.
That's right. We'll come back at 3 o'clock and preempt the takeaway. So first, remind people about your role with Washington State. The media sometime call you the pot czar a few years ago.
Yes. That was inaccurate. I was never a Washington State official. My company, Botech Analysis, won the contract to advise what was then the Washington State Liquor Control Board, is now the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board, preserving the acronym, put together the regulations for their commercial market. I don't like to say recreational because people are buying cannabis for a whole bunch of reasons. The outlines of the –
A whole bunch of – I mean, there's recreational and there's medicinal. Are there others?
There are people who are smoking because they're dependent on cannabis and are simply maintaining their habit. There are people who are worshiping. There are people who are trying to relax. I mean, it's not obviously a medical condition. I think it's more complicated than recreational versus medicinal. I think commercial is more accurate.
Are you keeping up with it in Washington State? Does the state seem does the electorate seem happy with what they wrought?
Far as I can tell, the electorates in all the legalizing states are relatively happy so far. There's not been a backlash. Both Washington and Colorado, which are the two that are furthest along, succeeded in what they intended to do, which was set up a regulated market, and that worked, and the stuff's being grown legally and the taxes are being paid. We calculate that about 2/3 of the cannabis now sold in Washington goes through one of the legal systems.
And
now,
they're different, right? How do you buy cannabis in Washington legally versus Colorado?
They're much more the same now than they were.
Okay.
When the commercial legalization happened, Colorado had open medical marijuana. Basically, anybody could get a recommendation. And they had licensed and regulated stores that were paying taxes. Washington also had open medical marijuana, But the stores weren't actually legal. So they weren't licensed. They weren't regulated. They weren't anything. So Colorado could basically put a new sign over the medical marijuana stores and make them commercial marijuana stores, mm-hmm. and they were done. Mm-hmm. Washington had to set up a whole brand new system. So it took them a little longer. But yeah, there. You know, you go into the store, you show that you're 21, you buy your weed. And both states and all the legalizing states base their new policies on the alcohol model, which is a familiar model. I think it's a terrible model.
Really?
I think it's a terrible model for alcohol. It won't be as bad for cannabis because cannabis is not as dangerous a drug. But setting up a system where smart people can get rich by generating large numbers of people with drug problems is not a great idea. Most people who use cannabis don't have a problem with it. They're Saturday night smokers. And as far as I can tell, there's no evidence of any damage from that. The 20% of people who use cannabis in the last year who use it almost every day, it's about 8 million people, account for 85 or 90% of the pot sold. So the commercial market is – and the medical market for that matter – are directed entirely toward those people who are smoking more pot than is good for them.
85 to 90% of the pot being sold is being sold to people who smoke or use it in some way every day.
Or almost every day.
You're characterizing as problem users.
Well, about half of them, when you ask them the diagnostic questions, seem to meet criteria for substance use disorder. But that's by their own self-report. My guess is if you ask their friends, you might get a different report.
So let me ask you, you know, to the extent of your knowledge on Washington State and Colorado, an upside effect and if it's playing out, and a downside effect and if it's playing out. And on the upside, our last segment was very much about criminal justice reform. Are we seeing fewer unnecessary contacts with the criminal justice system, especially among young people of color, because we know that they're disproportionately, you know, approached by the police for marijuana compared with whites? Has that gone down in Colorado and Washington State in, you know, to an extent that it's really having an effect? And on the downside, are we seeing more marijuana dependency problem users because it's more readily available?
Question mark answers to both of those questions. So in the first one, cannabis arrests are down in both states, and they were disproportionately minority. The racial disproportion in cannabis arrests has gone up.
Say that again.
The racial disproportion in cannabis arrests has gone up. So
Who's still getting arrested for cannabis if it's legal?
People selling it on the street. You know, about a third of the Washington market, we figure, is completely illicit.
Still. Because it's cheaper?
Because it's cheaper, because there hasn't been a law enforcement push. My sense is that the illicit market is a relic and could be relatively easily pushed out. Mm-hmm. But part of the political theme of the legalization campaign was to get law enforcement out of the cannabis business.
Right.
And so the police are not very happy about cannabis legalization. Sort of cross their arms and say, okay.
So if it's legal to be sold in stores, why would they even enforce it? Is it like the stores
that
sell – oh, it's tax evasion. Right.
It's tax evasion.
And unfair competition for the stores that are paying rent for their brick-and-mortar places.
And access to minors and sale of stuff that's not regulated where the state tries to regulate.
Okay.
I mean, it's all the reasons to not allow illegal activity. But they're not doing very much of it. And the reason to do it is when cannabis is illegal, I think cannabis enforcement is completely worthless. Because you take one dealer off, you're replacing with a different dealer. There's no gain. Once there's a legal cannabis market, enforcement against the illegal market can drive people into the legal market, which is what you want. So the value of cannabis enforcement goes up with legalization. Well, I can't convince anybody of that.
How about dependency?
Good question. Way too early to tell. Again, partly Colorado and Washington already had wide-open cannabis availability. That didn't change very much. I mean, in Colorado, a lot of the sales, early sales, were to tourists, right? Because their access had changed. But if you were a Colorado resident and you wanted cannabis, you got a medical recommendation or you had a friend who had one.
You still had to go to a doctor. right?
Well, somebody had to go to a doctor.
Yeah.
But, you know, one person's recommendation could supply all his friends. I mean, I don't think
they were that open-ended, the prescriptions?
Well, I mean, again, legally they're not prescriptions. They're just a statement from the doctor that he recommends that somebody try cannabis.
I see. So there's not a dose or
right, which is why
3 ounces and 2 refills 30 days later.
Right. I mean, which is why cannabis has medical value. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Some of the chemicals in the cannabis have medical value. Therefore, the plant has medical value. Medical marijuana is mostly a joke because if I go to my doctor and have an infection, she does not say to me, you have an infection. I recommend that you take some antibiotic. She gives me a prescription for 100 milligrams of amoxicillin 3 times a day for 7 days with meals.
Right.
Right. There's nothing like that in cannabis, partly because marijuana is not one thing. Right. The mix of chemicals in different flowers is enormous. So they can't all be good for all diseases. But partly due to federal restrictions, nobody's done the appropriate research. And, of course, the people in the stores who are making recommendations to patients about what they should take are guys with ponytails and no training. One of the things I'd like to see that no state has done yet is a vendor training rule that says if you're going to sell cannabis across the counter, you need pharmacology training, you need substance abuse prevention training, you're going to get a professional license, and you're going to have a fiduciary duty to the customer to make a recommendation in the customer's interest, not the store owner's interest. Mm. That seems to me would be a good thing to do, but nobody's done it. But back to your question.
They can't even get that on Wall Street with the stockbrokers acting in their clients' interest. They're trying to repeal that.
Exactly.
That's another show.
Exactly. Thank you, Donald Trump. So the prices only started – the legal prices only fell below the medical prices. Commercial prices only fell below the medical prices about a year ago. That's way too short a period of time to see, you know, new dependency
effects. All right. My guest, if you're just joining us, is Mark Kleiman, who it's fair to say is a marijuana expert. He's a professor of public policy at NYU, author of the book Drug Policy, What Everyone Needs to Know. And among other things, he was a consultant to the state of Washington as they were implementing their legal commercial marijuana system after the referendum there, 3 years ago now? Roughly thereabouts.
No, the referendum was 5 years ago.
5 years ago, that much. 212-433-WNYC is our phone number. We're going to go on to some other things. We're going to talk about Canada. We're going to talk about Jeff Sessions. We're going to talk about medical marijuana and how tough it is to get, the opposite of what we were just hearing about with respect to Colorado and Washington, in New York State. 212-433-WNYC. If you have any questions, 433-9692. So how much can Attorney General Sessions turn back what you were just describing in Washington and Colorado if he wants to?
If he wanted to, he could turn it all back. But he won't.
You don't think?
I don't think, because doing so would be a disaster even from the drug war hawk point of view. Shutting down the legal markets is easy. All of those people filed applications with the state to do what the federal government considers a felony. So all the Justice Department has to do is take those applications into district court, federal district court, and get an injunction against absolutely everybody who has a license.
Because the laws don't match. The state has enabled something that is actually still federally against the law.
Correct. Which the state can do, right? There's no obligation for the state to have a matching law to the federal law.
But the federal government has to decide to look the other way.
Right, or not. So assume they decide not to look the other way. They go into court. They get an injunction against absolutely everybody who has a license. So now nobody can do anything under their state license. And now what do they do about the illicit market? The basic fact of this problem is that there are 4,000 DEA agents and 500,000 state and local cops. So this isn't federalism in the Supreme Court. This is federalism on the street. Uh-huh. The feds do not have the horses to enforce their own drug laws without state and local help. And the Controlled Substances Act orders the Attorney General to cooperate with state and local governments. So I think what Holder did was probably correct legally. And it certainly made sense from a policy point of view. You could all you could do is replace a licit market with an uncontrolled illicit market, and that's got to be a loser. Colorado actually – the legislature just passed a bill saying that if the federal government shuts down the commercial system, Sessions always said he's not going to touch medical marijuana.
Right.
All of the stores can reclassify themselves that day into medical marijuana stores.
Yes. But then they need to set up another system for legally procuring it, right?
Well, no. If the Attorney General doesn't want to interfere with state medical marijuana systems, that means not interfering with growing either.
Right. And
which the Congress has told them to do, right?
What
the
about
Congress,
some states that passed it on this past election day but haven't implemented it yet? California did, and in our area, Massachusetts right?
did, which is very important because it means the whole I-95 corridor has cannabis. It can't be expensive in New York and cheap in Boston. That doesn't last.
Because you can take a Bolt bus for $20.
Right. Yeah. Again, he could shut that down, but then what? If Massachusetts legislature passes a medical marijuana bill that allows everybody who wants to claim medical use to – I mean, if the states really want to do it, they can do it. And if they don't want to enforce against the illicit market, which they don't, right? Nobody wants to add to the number of arrests. I think the fact about cannabis prohibition is that it's over. I think people who wanted to restrict the use of cannabis can justifiably say, guys, we gave it the good old college try.
Here's another sign of that probably before we go to some phone calls. Canada. Do I have this right that this came from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau himself?
Yes.
A proposal for nationwide legalization of marijuana.
Correct. This was part of his election campaign. They're committed to having a law on the books during this parliament. They did it carefully. They didn't do it by referendum. And Trudeau said at the very beginning of the process that the goal was to make cannabis available to adults for moderate use and to eliminate the illicit market while protecting public health. And it's that kicker that's never been part of the American discussion. Now, again, Canada
which
is –
which means funding rehab and
– No. That's the nonsense version of protecting public health.
Okay.
The real version of protecting public health is making sure that the supply system doesn't promote heavy use. And partly you do that simply by keeping the price up.
Huh.
One of the basic facts about cannabis and this is in a book that John Calkins and Bo Kilmer and I just published, Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know.
Forgive me. I should have had that title from the start.
Sorry. So what one of the basic facts about cannabis is if it were a legal product, a joint would cost what a tea bag costs. Right? They're both dried plant matter in a wrapping.
Right?
So you're talking about a nickel rather than $4 for the cannabis in a joint. If you let that happen, I think heavy use is going to explode.
So this is like why we tax cigarettes so much.
Exactly. And one way to think about this is that we're regulating cannabis like alcohol. And tobacco is going to regulate cannabis like cigarettes. They're going to say, we don't want to make this illegal, but we're not going to encourage it. And that would be a big change. But here, a lot of the referendum money now comes from the industry. And, you know, getting advice from the cannabis industry about cannabis use disorder is like getting advice from ExxonMobil about global warming.
It's like any other industry.
Right, exactly.
Ken in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Mark Kleiman, author of the new book, Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. Hi.
Hi. Something that's always worried me is that since marijuana has been illegal, we haven't been able to do any of those great big long-term longitudinal studies. So what do we know about the health effects? Are we going to legalize it, then use goes up, and then 40 years later we find out we all have cancer, like we did with cigarettes?
It's a good question. There has been an aggressive effort by the National Institute on Drug Abuse to study the health effects of cannabis. And they are looking only for bad effects. They're never interested in benefits. And I have to say they've come up reasonably dry. There are some worrisome things. There's a bunch of carcinogen in cannabis smoke. Nobody's ever demonstrated increased cancer among cannabis users.
Because you just don't smoke enough?
Well, or because most cannabis...
Even if you're a regular user, you know, if you're smoking right. half a pack of cigarettes a day, that's 10 cigarettes. Some people are smoking 10 joints a day, but almost nobody.
Exactly right. So it might be the case that even though there's lots of carcinogen, there's not much cancer. Or it might be the case that we haven't done the studies right. Part of the problem is that unlike 40 years ago, contemporary cannabis smokers are almost all tobacco smokers. And so any effect of their cannabis use gets lost in the effect of their tobacco use.
Say that again. Contemporary cannabis users?
Overwhelming. Again.
Are tobacco users?
Are tobacco users? Yes. No. I mean, this is – John Calkins says, and I think he's right, that part of the problem with the discussion about cannabis is that we're still having a Whole Foods debate about what's become a Walmart drug. And everybody who gets to talk about cannabis has an advanced degree and remembers when cannabis was an upper middle class activity, more common among kids who thought they were going to go to college than among kids. No, it's gone way downscale, partly because it's gotten very cheap, right? So while we've been arguing about legalization, on the illicit market side, the price of a stoned hour has fallen by about a factor of four. The pot costs the same, but it's got about four times as much THC in it. And coincidentally, the number of stoned hours has gone up by about a factor of four. So it looks to me like intoxication is price elastic, and therefore we should legalize but prevent the price from falling, which is what the Netherlands did. The Netherlands has legal retail, but the production's still illegal, and the price is high.
And it's what you said Canada is looking at.
It's not clear. I mean, Canada has the intention of protecting public health. Details of that are open. Canada is even more federal than we are. So what the Canadian federal government does is pass enabling legislation and turn it over to the provinces. So we're going to have 10 different systems in Canada. Some of them may be better than others.
Bina in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Bina, thank you so much for calling.
Hi. I wanted to chime in on this. I'm glad that you're discussing this, but I wanted to put in a good word for medical marijuana in New York. I work at a medical marijuana dispensary in White Plains, and I definitely take issue, or at least I disagree with what your expert is saying about the – I agree with you that there's really not enough research in the United States about what will help different people with different illnesses, but – I work for a company that is owned and run by physicians, and I have a master in public health, and I work with pharmacists, and we really do not just sell people stuff that we think is going to get them high. In fact, most of the people who are coming to us are getting there's more than one component in marijuana, and the one that makes people high is not necessarily the one that's beneficial to them. There are many people coming for CBD, which is an anti-inflammatory, and it helps people, say, with MS who have muscle spasms and tremors. And there's, I do strongly agree with you that there's not enough research, but don't discount the fact that, I mean, we take our patient care very seriously. This, I'd say, the main problem in New York State actually is that it still is very expensive in New York. But I really wanted to correct that. It's not like there's a bunch of 20-year-olds playing hacky sack in our lobby. It really is a clinic. And the other thing that I really wanted to make sure that people are aware of is it's not as if marijuana is something that is only smoked. In New York State, everything is oil-based. So we have capsules that have oil inside. We have a liquid solution that is oil-based. And we have vaporizers where people can sort of similar concept to an e-cigarette where they vaporize right. the oil. There's no actual combustion, so it's considered to be less toxic. And there is no mixing with tobacco when you do medical in New York.
So would you say there are different kinds of marijuana or marijuana-related products that people can get at your dispensary that the doctors are beginning to know which kind is the most relevant to what kind of condition? And that people can come to you and say, I want a kind that does get me high, or I want a kind that doesn't get me high?
People can say that, but we honestly have – it is so difficult in New York to qualify for marijuana. I mean, it's not as though anybody could go to a doctor and say, I want to get high. Or – I mean, I'm sure there are people who slide in under the radar, but I would say – I've worked at this dispensary since shortly after it opened, became legal in New York State a little over a year ago. Mm-hmm. And I would say 95 to 98% of the people that I've seen are genuinely ill.
I'm not saying people
are... Many of them are coming...
Yeah, I'm not saying anybody's faking it. I'm just saying once they get to the point of having a prescription and coming to you, are those options actually available that somebody could say, I want a kind that only eases my symptoms and doesn't get me high, or I want a kind that does both?
I suppose people could technically do that. It is not something that happens here, though. I can't speak about other companies, but I can say that when you come to us and you share your medical history and we meet with you and we talk about the different options that are available to you, I have not encountered anybody who said, well, I really just want to get high, or anyone I really suspect that that's why they're here.
Right. Mark, you want to talk to Bina?
It's an excellent illustration of the difference between real medical marijuana laws, which a bunch of East Coast states have, and nonsense medical marijuana laws, which are common west of the Mississippi. In California, where the original referendum talked about AIDS in cancer patients, fewer than 3% of people in buying from dispensaries have AIDS or HIV or a cancer diagnosis. So yes, if you really restrict who gets it, if you make it expensive, if you make it oil not flour, you can push it in the medical direction. You're still stuck with the fundamental ignorance that we have about the different chemicals and what they do. So I'm not saying that having a medical cannabis system is impossible, even with today's knowledge. But it's not what existed in California.
Bina, what makes it so hard in New York State?
I think what makes it hard, there are a few things. One is that if someone were to come to the dispensary and say, I have these issues, I want to know how to get marijuana, we actually legally are not allowed to direct them to a physician because the state wants them to turn to their primary care doctor so that doctor stays in the loop. There's a good intent behind the law, but
and they don't want your company to have a conflict of interest referring people to get prescriptions for your product.
Right. Now, by contrast, in California, I went into a dispensary, and this may be 7-8 years ago, because I learned about the prices. And they said, no, we can't talk to you if you don't have a recommendation. And they handed me a laminated 6x9 card from their pet doctor with, marijuana leaf curlicues on it. And it told me how to get a recommendation.
Right.
And it said, if we can't give you a recommendation, your visit is free. Mm-hmm. There was another physician in Westwood, where UCLA is, that had a storefront. And the storefront had a quote from the law, marijuana may be recommended for any condition for which it may be helpful, including colon, and a double column list of symptoms in case the patient was too stoned to remember what he was pretending to have. So that's one version of medical marijuana. The New York State version is a very different version, but it serves relatively few people.
Bina, how, in your experience in the field now, would you recommend loosening the medical marijuana law in New York State if the legislature was willing to actually serve more people with medical uses?
I think that the two main barriers are cost. And the other one is access, finding out how to do it. And even though you can go online and learn what you need to, the process that you need to go through, I think finding a doctor is really that first critical step. And I think because the state doesn't have, technically you can find a doctor, but the process that you have to go through is so arduous and often so impossible if you're asking a primary care doctor who really is not tapped into this. We're not supportive of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to get a doctor. And so there's sort of in this information vacuum, sometimes people step in who are not necessarily physicians who have the patient's best interest at heart. I would say for the most part, the physicians who are basically mainstream doctors who have taken this continuing education course, though they really do prioritize patient care, and they're in this for the right reasons.
And we're just about out of time, but there are also few dispensaries, right?
There are very few dispensaries, and actually in the spread of them, it's not as if they're equally spread across the state. So, I think that has to do with the way the initial process.
There are others besides yours in White Plains in the downstate area?
No, there's not others besides us in White Plains, but, for example, I believe there are three different companies in Albany, but there's nothing serving, say, Rockland County or Orange County.
Or the city?
So, in the city, there are two. There's one in Queens and there's one in Manhattan, Bronx also.
Thank you very much. A last word, and then we're out of time, about New York State and what you think of the medical marijuana system that's been set up here, besides that it's real compared to California. Is it as functional as it could be?
I haven't studied it closely enough. But again, New York State, like everybody else, is going to have to deal with the fact that people who want cannabis for non-medical reasons and people who aren't for medical reasons are going to be able to get it on that bus from Boston pretty soon. And I think the state ought to deal with the fact that cannabis legalization, that the cannabis prohibition is simply no longer functional, and think about how we're going to legalize.
How far away are they away in Massachusetts from actually having the stores?
Given the Colorado and Washington experience, I would guess 2 years to opening, probably another year. There'll be product shortage because the growers get licensed slowly. So 3 years from now, I would expect stuff to be coming down the pipe cheaply. But as it is, it's not that long a plane ride from Seattle, where you can get high quality flower for $95 an ounce.
It's a long enough plane ride to Seattle. Mark Kleiman, marijuana expert, professor of public policy at NYU, author of the books Drug Policy, What Everyone Needs to Know, and now Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. He's been a consultant to Washington State in its implementation of commercial marijuana. And thank you for filling us in on the marijuana news. So interesting.
Brian, always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.